Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, July 7th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman, Eric. Cherry, I will admit, I am a very specific type of soccer fan.
Okay.
World Cup comes around. I love it. I don't know why I love it.
You're a super fan during the World Cup.
The pageantry, something about it, the passion. I'm just eating it up.
Got your shirt on.
I got my shirt on today, my soccer shirt on, my kit. I just love it. I don't know what it is about the World Cup. I absolutely love it. Then the World Cup goes away, and I got no idea what's going on after that.
Yeah.
You know, I know some of the names of the big stars and stuff like that, but I'm not tuning in to watch any matches.
None
I don't really have a
between.
Team I'm following. You know, it just sort of evaporates for me. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's a class of fans out there that's like me.
Yeah.
And one of the questions we've been asking about this big home World Cup is, will the enormity of this tournament take fans like me and convert them into more permanent soccer fans? Will it help grow the game? Because the game has been growing over the decades, but people still feel like American soccer is not quite at its potential, mm-hmm. as evidenced by...
don't say it.
A bit of a loss last night. So we want to hear from you today on the program. We're going to talk about the state of American soccer, what this tournament has meant, what it hasn't meant, how politics have gotten involved. And we want to ask you, what has the 2026 World Cup meant to you? Do you think this is a watershed moment for the sport? Do you have World Cup takes? Get them in by calling us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, please drop a comment in the chat.
So do you think you will continue to watch at least the World Cup as it continues?
Yes, the World Cup. I don't know.
Next year,
I tried to pick an English soccer team a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I'm going to pick one. I'm going to follow them. It was Tottenham.
Okay.
And I made it like a week. Like, seriously. And I was like, Tottenham, who? Hot Toddy? What was I talking about? I didn't know. I had no idea. And, you know, if you call in, tell me about how's Tottenham doing? I don't know.
You know what?
If you know how Tottenham's doing, can you please call the show 888-477-9499?
Oh my God.
And the thing is, it's nothing about the sport. I find the sport compelling. I don't know what it is. I just, you know, I've got my attention is already kind of soaked up by the other big four.
Yeah. And I will say, I did watch some of the games. And, you know, I'm not a soccer person, but I'm wearing my black today and mourning for the U.S. team. But 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear your takes on what the World Cup has meant to you and to the city and to America.
How are the Tottenham Hotspurs doing? Just please, someone tell
me. Somebody's going to email you.
Someone tell me what's going on.
All right. We have our trio of local news stories. And the story we're kicking it off is one we mentioned yesterday.
Yeah.
Some good news. The PICO worker strike has ended, and it only took 3 days. Looks like PICO reached a deal with the IBEW Local 614, ending the first ever strike in the utility's 145-year history. The union leaders are celebrating the tentative agreement, which includes pensions and retirement benefits for newly hired workers, as well as increased pay. The 1,600 member unit includes linemen, gas techs, facilities workers, and call center workers as well. I have to mention there was a major sticking point. The linemen and gas techs, those are jobs filled mostly by men, and they were able to secure higher raises over the course of the 5-year deal than for the customer service workers, which are mostly female. And the union said they fought hard for across the board equal raises, but they weren't unable to accomplish that. But they still say this is a major victory. PICO also celebrated the deal, saying it shows their commitment to recognizing contributions of the workforce. The next step, of course, is for union members to ratify the agreement, and the workers will be back on the job tomorrow. And it couldn't happen sooner,
yes.
Avi, because we had those torrential rains over the past few days.
Yeah, a lot of weather.
Heat. And so people want the power on because the AC got to keep pumping.
Absolutely. And look, another tension point in these negotiations was whether newer employees would have pensions or 401ks,
yep.
Or exactly how their retirement plans would play out. And that's something that just reflects a larger tension in American society. You know, the older generation having these pensions, younger folks being reliant on the 401ks, and that was playing out as well in this strike. So it was interesting to see.
Yeah, but the older workers stood up for the young workers to make sure that they would be okay into the future. So.
Just like a mirror to society.
Yeah, it is.
Story number two, Cherry, it's time for some TikTok.
Uh-oh.
Not the sound a clock makes.
Okay.
Not a social media platform.
Okay.
It's time for some talk about ticks.
Mm-hmm.
Tick talk. Recent story in the Pennsylvania Capital Star says tick bites are surging across the country and here in the Commonwealth.
Ooh.
Tick bites in April reached levels not seen since 2017, according to the CDC. Warm temperatures may be part of that trend. We're also seeing tick season expanded because of rising global temperatures.
Yeah.
According to a service called MyWild, Pennsylvania is one of 11 high-risk states for tick activity in our region. Bucks, Montgomery, and Chester counties are all high-risk zones. As you probably know, the most common human disease caused by tick bites is Lyme disease, but there's also this illness called alpha-gal syndrome, which is on the rise, and it triggers an intense allergic reaction to red meat. So that's got a lot of folks worried as well. Big picture, right? Take precautions, do tick checks, and if you find a tick, remove it with tweezers.
Yeah, there are a lot of myths out there about what you should do,
to get rid of them.
And all that. That's not true. So prevention goes a long way. Bug spray, wearing long sleeves and pants and hats in wooded areas helps a lot. And I can't stress tick checks because I had a tick as a kid. But my mom, she used to always do tick checks, especially.
Oh, wow.
And I never noticed it. It was on the back of my leg. And that little bugger had like burrowed. And she was like, what? Let me check y'all, you know. And then pulled that sucker out with tweezers. And of course, nothing happened. I'm fine.
Yeah.
But still,
thank
it
God.
Was really, really scary. And they look, and it was all like, it gets all plump and everything. But I'll never forget it. And now I check if I go out.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you do picnics and stuff, even in high grass, I check. If you're under trees, check.
It's a good reminder.
So, yeah, it's just a reminder because Lyme disease can be really, really serious if it's not caught early.
It really freaks me out, to be honest. And I wish I was remembering more often to do the tick checks. But maybe today will be a reminder for me as well.
Yep. And we have a third story.
Third story. Go ahead.
The golden age of my favorite meal, brunch, is upon us here in Philadelphia. It is seeing a major renaissance thanks to innovative Philadelphia chefs. I got to shout out Kiki Aranita for this amazing story in Philadelphia Inquirer about how a gaggle of local chefs known for breaking ground when it comes to dinner have turned their attention on brunch. And they're killing it.
They're killing it.
They're killing it.
They're killing
right
it.
Right here in the city. And for years, according to the Inky, restaurants dreaded having to create something for the not quite breakfast, not quite lunch meal, because people get confused about what belongs on there. It can get expensive. But now they're viewing it as an opportunity. And you should check out the article because they list a bunch of cool places like Menong and Fairmount, Little Water and Rittenhouse. They have things like Wingco cassava and coconut pancakes at Rice and Sambal in South Philly.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and they are purple. Okay.
Okay.
So if you like a little unique, you know, brunch, that there's that. Also sourdough pancakes at Dance Robot. And I gotta shout out some of my low key spots.
Shout
Sook
them
City
out.
On Spring Garden. And if you like something a little more upscale, there's Amina in Northern Liberties or Love in Rittenhouse. And I have to say, I just love brunch.
You love it.
I love brunch. It's like my favorite meal.
You
got to
get like
meals.
A shirt that says the brunch bunch or something. You really love brunch.
I love brunch. And so it got me to thinking. So what are your favorite brunch meals?
I keep it basic. You know, I go with probably an omelet, home fries, toast, you know, the classic trio.
Okay.
But if I was going for a more adventurous brunch option, I do love dim sum.
Okay.
I find dim sum really to be delicious.
Okay, I like that. That's good because you know you can pick anything. You can go breakfast. You can go lunch.
What are you? What's your brunch thing?
I'm gonna go. I love a good omelet with a salad though because I got to mix it up.
Mm.
And I have to have a biscuit with that, and then I have to have a blood orange margarita.
This is pretty specific.
Oh yeah.
Omelet, a salad, a biscuit, and a blood orange.
Blood orange margarita.
Not an orange margarita. It's got to be blood
orange.
Because
I need a drink with mine.
Yeah.
And then if I'm going a little simpler, you know, I'll go with some Prosecco and you know, a breakfast burrito.
So I think...
That's fish and grits. That too. I gave our producer so many things. Yeah.
You forgot what your favorite was.
Oh, yeah. Fish and grits.
So
love it.
I do feel like there was always... I feel like the chef community and the foodie community likes to look down on brunch. They see it as kind of basic. And the idea was that what chefs do is to kind of take all the scraps, throw them in some eggs, call it brunch.
Yeah, but that's not what we want.
And I think what the article was saying is that the chefy types are starting to take it more seriously and really crafting brunch menus, which I appreciate.
And they're elevating the meal of brunch, and I'm here for it.
But maybe they'll elevate it in a way you don't like, because you like the old brunch.
I like all brunch. I'm willing to lean in and go for something new, like bring it to me.
As an old brunch devotee, could you be convinced to like new brunch?
I could. I want some sourdough pancakes.
New brunch.
I'll go with it.
New brunch is better than new Coke, folks.
That's right. Let's do it.
All right. We're going to talk about soccer today on the show. Get your soccer thoughts in. 888-477-9499. Studio 2 at WHYY.org. Don't go anywhere. We kick off in a moment.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Errant, last night the USA men's national soccer team suffered a brutal defeat at the hands of Belgium, dashing hopes of a World Cup crown. Here's what former American soccer star Alexi Lalas had to say after the game on Fox Sports.
I think that this team did win hearts and minds. I think this team did bring people into the tent, and they should be incredibly proud for that. But also, there's a part of me that says the time for moral victories is over. And so we've left something on the table here.
But commentator Thierry Henry, the French soccer legend, added some encouraging words.
I just wanted to add something. People out there, yes, there is a disappointment on the result. But let's not stop pushing this sport in this country.
Yeah, to Henri's point, the last time we hosted the FIFA World Cup in 1994, soccer was just a twinkle in the eye of most Americans. But according to a recent survey, 1 in 10 Americans now say it is their favorite sport. The World Cup has brought joy all over the country, especially in host cities like Philly.
So today on the show, what has hosting this international jubilee meant for Americans? Is the USA finally joining the rest of the world and becoming a soccer country? Or will politics off the pitch overshadow the tournament?
To tackle all of that, we're joined by two diehard soccer fans. And joining us via Zoom is Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic and co-creator of Golden Goal, a single-issue magazine about the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Alex, welcome to Studio 2.
It's great to be with you.
And with us in studio, we have Jose Nunez, a soccer journalist who covers the Philadelphia Union and has covered 5 of the 6 World Cup matches right here in Philadelphia for Major League Soccer's website. Jose, thanks for joining us.
Of course. This is a pleasure.
Yeah. And for our newcomer, long time, or just soccer, you know, first timers, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What has the 2026 World Cup meant to you? Do you think this is a watershed moment for the sport? You can give us a call and participate. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube streamers, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Okay, so as we start this conversation, I want to bring in a caller. This is Thomas from Allentown. Mm-hmm. But before Thomas starts talking, I think based on what he's going to say, we have to explain that there was a controversy before last night's match, which is that one of the U.S.'s star players was supposed to be suspended for the match because of a prior red card infraction. Then FIFA suspended his red card, allowing him to play in that game. We know that President Trump talked to the head of FIFA in the period when this decision was made. We don't know that his intervention is what caused FIFA to suspend the red card and allow the player to ultimately perform last night. But that sets us up, I think, for Thomas's call. Thomas from Allentown, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment to start us off this hour?
I'm infuriated.
You're infuriated why?
I am infuriated because we got destroyed by a team that we gave all the motivation in the world to destroy us. And they came in and just made us look like we didn't even belong on the stage. Mm. And it was all because the first winner of the FIFA FIFA Peace Prize decided he needed to make this event about himself which my first World Cup was 94, and we watched on Telemundo because it was barely on television. So I've been following for quite a while, and yeah, I would say that our lovely commander in chief contributed to us getting destroyed, which drives me insane.
Well, look, a lot of folks, I think, sympathize with your position, Thomas. Thank you so much.
Thomas is grieving over there.
So that's actually a great jumping off point for this whole conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Because what happened over the last 48 to 72 hours is the final taste in the mouth for a lot of American soccer fans. This intervention by Trump, this shadow of corruption, and then this terrible defeat. And yet you juxtapose that with a tournament where a lot of people felt a lot of joy for the many weeks leading up to that. So after this moment, and I'll start with you, Alex Shepard, is the arrow still pointing up for American soccer and American soccer fandom in this country? Is it flat? Is it pointing down? The overall trend and trajectory as we sit here in the shadow of this defeat.
Oh, I mean, I think it's absolutely pointing up. I think that there's very little to feel good about. I think both for the reasons that the caller just mentioned just now and the performance on the field. I think those two things were probably related. But I think for me, what I think about is the 2014 game against Belgium, where this team dramatically overperformed against a very good Belgian team that includes some of the same players that played last night. And this team underperformed against the same Belgian team. But the difference between those two teams in 2014 and 2026 is just incredible. I think this is still the most talented team that the U.S. has ever put out there. It still is maybe a golden generation, but I think the larger picture that we're seeing here is that soccer has arrived in this country, right? That's the big difference between 94 and today, and that's what we're seeing around here. And, you know, does that mean that we are going to compete for the World Cup immediately? Probably not, but we're a sort of Netherlands or Belgium level country right now, and that's something I think to be really proud of.
Yeah, do you agree, Jose? Do you feel like overall, in terms of fan interest, in terms of the quality of the players America produces, the arrow is still pointing up, even despite the setback last night?
I would wholeheartedly agree. I think as you think about this digital age where information travels so fast and moves so quickly and you can reach places that you couldn't before in 1994. I think of the story of the Scots in Boston, right? In 1994, that might have been maybe a newspaper article here, the entire world.
This was the Scottish fans invading Boston when the Scottish team was playing there during the World Cup.
Correct. So you kind of see these scenes just continuing to proliferate and be shared by everybody. Never mind hearing about the developments here in terms of MLS and how it has been growing over the years, seeing more and more MLS players take the leap to go abroad. And sure, the current team has a lot of those players that have made the leap over to Europe to get that valuable experience. I think that you look no further than even here in Philadelphia with the Kevin Sullivans of the world, a teenager who has a pre-contract with Manchester City, a behemoth of a team out in England, when he turns 18. So you kind of see that these footsteps are laid out. They just need to continue to follow them and trust the process again in a Philadelphia way. To be completely fair, I think that unfortunately for the next 4 years, a little bit longer than that, the first thing that people will remember about this U.S. men's national team will be the last 72 hours. That's the sour taste that it's left in everybody's mouth leading into the 2030 World Cup.
Yeah,
I got to read a comment. Aaron says on Facebook, it's the Trump curse. Everything that the man touches loses. Nick's only loss of the finals was him. He got involved with the U.S. soccer and they lost. He even said Chiefs were going to win Super Bowl in 24 and Eagles blew them out. So that's Aaron's take about the Trump curse. And I wanted to sort of ask both of you. I mean, the U.S. is used to winning in every sport that we take seriously, right? We're used to dominating across the world. Look at us at the Olympics. We win a lot of gold medals, you know, and we like to dunk on people, you know. And that's just the personality of American sports fans and athletes. And so I wanted each of you to get your take. I mean, when Americans look at soccer, especially men's soccer, because women are a little bit different. They've been dominating for quite some time. But, you know, for men's soccer, we don't always win. We don't dominate there. And so your take on how American fans who are used to seeing Americans be dominant in everything that we take on, how they're supposed to take this loss, especially the ones who are for the first time paying attention And we'll start with you here in the studio. Yeah,
it's a process again.
Yeah,
it's a tournament that comes around every 4 years, I should say, and it's sacred, and only one team can win it. And now that you have an expanded tournament with more teams being involved, it becomes that much more difficult. And sure, the U.S. went and beat some good teams in Paraguay as well as Bosnia. But the reality is, as I believe it was Thierry Henry who said it, there are some serious levels to this. The U.S. just needs to understand that they're sort of still adapting to the game, right, in terms of how they can compete and how they can develop. Look no further than even a local radio station here that continues to have the argument that, you know, if NFL players and NBA players had actually chosen to play soccer, it would be a completely different sport and the U.S. would be dominating. But the reality is that the best player in the world that happens to play in the United States is no more than 5'7", maybe 130 pounds wet and has a pretty bad posture when sitting down. I don't know that athleticism gets them that. I think it's obviously between the shoulders and certainly being at the sport from the get-go and being willing to understand that this is a process.
Yeah, and Alex, I'd love to get your take on that because as you know, I think for a lot of fans who are first tuning in to the different levels that exist, you know, you see Messi playing. Maybe you had heard about him, but you hadn't seen him do like wizardry on the field. Yeah. And you're like, oh, my gosh. And then you see, you know, the American team and you're like, oh, wow, we need to do better. So why do you think it's sort of taken us so long to sort of build the type of team, like, because you both said that this is one of the best team that men's team that America has had. So why is it taking so long?
Yeah, I mean, well, as we've been talking, you know, Messi just missed a penalty against Egypt, right? This is hard, right? It's hard to win.
Breaking news, man. I didn't know that.
He has it right there. You know,
I was like, I keep glancing down. Yeah. But, you know, it's hard to do. You know, I think that there was an arrogance to the U.S. soccer project when it started after 94. You know, in 1998, they started this thing called Project 2010, right? And the idea was we're going to win a World Cup by 2010. It's this idea that this is the richest country in the world. We have the best athletes, right? We just have to marshal resources. And, you know, it's difficult to do. I think one of the things, you know, I had a friend who texted me about Belgium. They said, yeah, you know, it's a country the size of Ohio. And I said, well, yeah, but if you're a good soccer player in Belgium, it's so dense that you will never fall through the cracks, right? And I think what we've seen here is this country has slowly figured out how to bring more and more people who are talented into places where they can develop properly. And I think while this has been happening, which is something that I think nobody foresaw back in 1994, the rest of the world has gotten better too, right? Partly that's because of what we're seeing now with this kind of diaspora World Cup, with teams doing a better job, as the U.S. has too, of finding players that technically qualify who may not live in these nations. But, you know, I think that this team is actually really quite good. It didn't look like that against Belgium, but, you know, I think this is a team that has put together a lot of the right pieces and that they didn't have before. One of the things I think about this tournament that really stands out to me are, yes, you know, some of these teams are smaller, but, you know, Paraguay, right, they finished ahead of Colombia in qualifying. The U.S. Beat their socks off, frankly, and like, we have not seen the U.S. play like that in a tournament before. The U.S. has always been stodgy. They've been technically deficient, and I think for the first time we're seeing a team that plays the way that you want to see a soccer team play.
So there has been
the aesthetics. The aesthetics have changed, and for folks like us that are casuals, we don't quite catch that. We'd love to hear from you this hour, by the way. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. What has the 2026 World Cup meant to you? Do you think this is a watershed moment for the sport in America? Let me read in some of the comments we've gotten so far. Harold on YouTube says, this World Cup made me a fan. I love it.
All right.
Jane says, I'm bummed that Trump's interference changed the mojo for Team USA, but delighted that Philly and the U.S. and North American cities seem to have beautifully hosted the matches and international visitors. Mary from Berwyn says, how about acknowledging that women's soccer success has led to a surge in interest here in America? Let's talk about the fan side of it. We've talked about the quality of the players on the pitch, but I think when you compare this moment right now to when the U.S. was eliminated from the 1994 tournament, Jose, how has fan interest and engagement in the sport writ large, not just the World Cup, changed from that moment to now? What are the tangible differences that you see?
I don't think you have to look much further than a random Thursday game, a World Cup game hosted at Philadelphia Stadium.
Yes.
That two nations, nothing to do with the United States outside of maybe having pockets of populations in New Jersey, New York, selling out on a Thursday at 4 p.m.
Yeah.
68,000 yeah. people that were there cheering, whether they were.
And what explains that? So, yeah, we saw like these Ivory Coast mm-hmm. versus Curacao, yes. Croatia versus Ghana. I mean, that's not just the diaspora population of those countries filling the stadium. This is just people who are interested in soccer who happen to be local or close enough to Philadelphia paying a lot of money. And I mean a lot of money mm-hmm. to watch those games. What explains that to you?
I think there's a sense of FOMO, right? Seeing the images and seeing the celebrations that people want to get in on. But the reality is that the world and soccer is so different from 1994 when the league was first getting started here in the U.S., never mind now having more access to games at any time than before. I know I can tune in at 6 o'clock in the morning, maybe even earlier, watch a free Japanese league game through my iPad, and then wait for the Premier League to start around 8-9 in the morning and continue to cycle through German, Austrian.
It's all right there at your fingertips.
It's all right there at your fingertips. So the access to the sport's so much easier now than it was back then. Never mind, especially here in Philadelphia, having a team to support. I know you had mentioned that, you know, World Cup comes, you are a fan, World Cup goes, you kind of lose track.
Yeah.
Well, there's a team that's 34 minutes away from you.
That's true. And in 94, right, that wasn't the case in Philadelphia.
There was no
Philadelphia Union.
Correct. So now there's a team here in your own backyard that people can get behind, especially those that felt that sense of FOMO, maybe went to watch a star or two during some of these games and now realized, you know what, this isn't so bad.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do want a word of caution. There are levels to this.
Yes,
right? A Philadelphia Union game is not what you're going to see in terms of talent when you go watch a World Cup game. But nonetheless, it's a sport.
Alex, your thoughts on maybe if you agree with Jose or other reasons you feel like the popularity of the sport as a spectator sport has grown since 1994. And we should be like in 1994, this sport was very, very popular all over the world. They didn't need digital media to convince them that this sport was worth watching. But I guess in this country, perhaps that convincing needed to be done. Your thoughts on the fan interest then and now?
Yeah, I was actually at that Ivory Coast Curacao game in Philadelphia. I drove down from New York and it was an amazing experience because I think it reflected that sense that there are just people who were there just to be there, right? That was one of the more affordable games, still quite expensive to go to. But the conversations that I was having from families that had driven in from North Carolina or from Ohio, from New York, you know, it was all about this sense of excitement about just participating in it. And I think that that's part of what we're seeing here too. Jose mentioned the Scottish fans in Boston. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great stories. You saw the sort of Kansas University fans like embrace Algeria. But I think one of the things that fans get here is that being a fan of the sport is really exciting. You know, the joke about soccer back in 1994, right, is that people just pass the ball slowly around and there's an announcer in Spanish and he's screaming the whole time, right, with excitement. But people, I think, are realizing that, one, the sport itself is extremely exciting, right? The goals are very rare and when they come, they're amazing. But two, I think it offers a tangible sense of kind of community that's actually quite rare in U.S. sports. I mean, you know, I'm a Knicks fan, right? I've been a Knicks fan my whole life. I love the Knicks. Mm. Knicks in five, baby. Mm. But sorry. But
don't make us go Jose the rest of the hour now, Alex.
Yeah.
Don't push
it. I had to do it. You know, I was like, New York City, baby. But you know, I think one of the things is what we saw here when we won the title was amazing, but it was very rare, right? And I think with soccer, there's this just kind of general sense of community, right? The Scottish team did not play well in this tournament, but their fans sort of came out. And I think people, when they encounter soccer fandom like that, they say, you know what, I want to be a part of that. And I think that that's what we're seeing here, you know? And, you know, the sport, I think, does not really need to grow that much more. I mean, I think it is, as I said earlier, it's fully arrived. But I think what we're seeing here too is that there are so many people that are recognizing now that there's something that there's left to explore. And Jose, as I mentioned, it's very easy to do.
Jose, you wanted to add something there?
What I want to add to that, and thank you so much for sharing and using the word fandom. I think what this tournament has done for a lot of people, not just here locally, but across the country, and maybe specifically across this country, is, I think, rewiring their brain to realize that there's more to going to a sport and being a customer.
Yeah.
There's more to it. You can be a fan and support this team. You can go to baseball games. I always use this example. Game whatever, 62 out of 160 that the Philadelphia Phillies mm-hmm. play, you usually see everybody sitting down with their arms crossed, just sort of taking it in. And that's okay. But if you watch Japanese baseball or Ecuadorian baseball or even the World Baseball Classic that just happened this year, there are drums. There's people just getting exciting, dancing, and, and just being fans rather than solely customers of the sport. And I think that's what this tournament has done, just rewiring the brain of what
those marches they did to the stadium. The fan groups would march to the stadium, and I said, oh, that's different. Like, I don't I don't really quite have a maybe tailgating sort of equivalent for a football game, but it was different. That's a good point. Go ahead.
Chance, it just seems so much fun. By the way, we'd love to hear from you. What has the 2026 World Cup meant to you? Do you think this is a watershed moment for the sport? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org, and our Facebook and YouTubers, keep those comments coming on in the live chat. Anthony says, this has been a magical World Cup on the field, with the exception of last night's difficult match. No other sport brings people from all corners of the planet together at a team level. Games like England versus Mexico or Cape Verde versus Argentina. I actually watched the game. They were incredible games. I was at the Ecuador upset of Germany, and a professor from Quito was next to me with his 11-year-old son. He was crying at the end. I also want to talk about a little bit about social media. And I want to throw this in there because for me, I'm a stories person. I'm not necessarily a sports person, but what makes me want to pay attention is when I hear the stories of like the Cape Verdean goalie who is 40 years old, you know, finally getting at his first World Cup, and, you know, one of his mom had to like jump through all these hoops to get his mom to come here. That made me want to watch that game. And so I wonder, like, that's a big difference between 1994 and today, Jose. And I'd love for you to just kind of give your take on how social media brought people who may not have necessarily been even paying attention, but then you see these amazing stories and all of a sudden you're like rooting for people that you don't even know just because their stories are so compelling.
Well, it's infectious, right? You watch one game that you have no attachment to. I myself, I'm Bolivian. My team obviously is not making the World Cup very often, if at all, but, you know, I lean towards Brazil. And the reality is that I watch some of these games with the smaller nations, and I'm thinking to myself, how cool would it have been for Argentina to have lost to, you know, that team and see this spectacle that would come from that. And I think social media, again, allows these stories to, whether they're on the field talking about results or off the field thinking about the fan fest celebrations across Philadelphia, whether they're at Lemon Hill or at Top Tomato with the American Outlaws or different bars where, you know, there's a sporting sense, or can be something as small as the Bank of America bracelets, which have caught the attention of everybody and somehow been sort of a random route for people to start paying attention to the tournament because they want to go, and then they get caught up in it.
Yeah, and I think about that, Alex, as social media sort of bringing stories, humanizing people, and then, you know, it kind of separates us from the politics, because a lot of people have been afraid that, you know, given the state of the world, you know, with our country being at odds with so many other countries and even with our allies, that that would impact how fans viewed their trips to the U.S. for the World Cup. Your thoughts on how just even the humanization of the different players and seeing people love Philadelphia and love other host countries sort of helped, I guess, dissipate some of that angst around the political part of it all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mostly write about politics, right? I report on politics. I edit political coverage for the New Republic. And that was one of my concerns as well. But I think one of the things that this tournament has shown us is that the sort of soccer always wins, or it usually does. I think it didn't really yesterday, but that was a rare instance, I think, of the sort of politics or the sort of scandals that often come along with the World Cup. And let's be very clear, like, FIFA has a long history of scandals and corruption, has a long history of aligning itself with autocracies and authoritarian nations. But one of the reasons why we still love the World Cup is that it sort of transcends these things. And I think for particularly for Americans who are concerned about the current administration, to maybe put it lightly, I think this tournament has done something really remarkable, which is it's reminded people that, you know, America is actually a friendly and welcoming place, and people like Americans. They like traveling around here. And, you know, my experiences here in New York, driving around to Philadelphia, certainly was just this sense of kind of enchantment that people have, you know, even though they'll also say, here's what I think about what do you think about the president? Here's what I think. But they want to talk about something else too.
Yeah. And Lookabear on YouTube says the best description of this World Cup was meeting your cousins, AKA the visiting fans, for the first time and finding out they're awesome. It's your parents, AKA your governments, that don't get along.
Oh, yeah.
We'd love to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. More World Cup talk on the other side of this break on Studio 2.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolf-Manera. Today, we're tackling the lasting legacy of the FIFA World Cup with two great reporters and soccer fans, Jose Nunez, Philadelphia Union beat reporter and contributor to MLSsoccer.com, covering the World Cup matches here in Philadelphia, as well as Alex Shepard, senior editor of The New Republic and co-creator of Golden Goal, a single-issue magazine about the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Yeah, and friends, we'd love to hear from you. What has the 2026 World Cup meant to you? Do you think this is a watershed moment for the sport? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming on the live chat. Camillagen on YouTube says, this World Cup has brought back the sense of social gatherings on weekdays, something that's felt extinct since COVID. I love that as well.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah, and we have a caller on the line. Kate from New Jersey is on the phone. Kate, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. In the late 1960s, I was a student at St. Andrews University in Scotland, and on my day off, I thought I'd go up to see what Aberdeen looked like. So I got on the train, and on the train were six young guys sitting together in a compartment. So as I walked by, they kind of gave me a smile, and I said, what do you all do? And they said, we're the Hearts of Midlothian. I said, what's that? And they said, she doesn't know what we are. They were the team for Scotland. And they were on their way to play a match in Aberdeen. So they said, well, you have to come with us, and we'll fix you up. So they gave me a free pass and let me meet with them after the match. But I went for the only game I'd ever seen, soccer match, or they call it football. It was thrilling. I couldn't believe it. I was thrilled. Everybody was going wild in the stands. And I thought, why doesn't America know what this is? And now they do.
Wow.
Yeah, great story.
That was great.
One of the themes of the tournament seems to be people love Scottish people.
They do.
And I've never been to Scotland. I don't know anything about it. But let me read this. This sort of a more pessimistic comment from Ellen on YouTube. The pricing of the matches in Philly really turned me off from all of it. Yeah, it was pretty darn expensive to go. John on YouTube says, here's my big question. Now that we love soccer, when will we get on board with the metric system? That's a bridge too far. That's a bridge too far, John. I do want to talk, because when we talk about the popularity of soccer as a spectator sport in this country, we talked about there being levels to how good the men's team is competitively. I think there's levels to fandom, too. And I do feel like there is a fundamental hurdle that soccer faces, which is that if you're a baseball fan in this country and you live in Philadelphia, we all like the Phillies, and we talk about the Phillies. And you can just go up to your neighbor and be like, hey, did you see that Phillies game the other day? Everyone knows it's a common language, right? It does feel like the soccer fandom experience, because of the digital nature of it, the international nature of it, is a little, like, diffuse and scattered. And there isn't one particular team that becomes, like, the gravity to be, like, the civic talking point, the way the Phillies, the Eagles, the Sixers, and the Flyers are. Jose, is that possible with the Union, or because MLS is considered an inferior league to the English league or the Spanish league, it will struggle to ever reach that kind of level, that if that makes sense?
I think one thing to keep in mind is that I think some listeners, and even me here in studio, I think I have still pairs of pants that are older than the Philadelphia Union.
Sure, it's very new, yes.
And I think some listeners may even have the same type of equipment that might be older than the league, right? It takes time. Mm-hmm. This is a league that's 30-odd years old and a team that's 15, 16, 17 years old. Yeah. So it's still very, very young in terms of the comparison of teams in England that have been around for 100 plus years, or even teams in South America that are, stadiums are not stadiums to them. Stadiums are cathedrals. Stadiums to them are places where something magical happens every single weekend from the crib onwards. They see the colors. They understand the colors. As a South American, I think about Boca Juniors or River Plate out in Argentina and the fierce rivalry. I think another thing to think about is just how spread this country really is compared to the density of other nations that have had these teams for hundreds of years. Where I think about a trip to Ireland that I took with my wife, and just in walking around, we ran into two or three different soccer stadiums around Dublin. So that alone, I think, makes it difficult. But my hope is that, again, with the popularity of the sport and kids learning more and more about the sport at a younger and younger age, it will lead to more stories and more fans that will realize, oh, there's something 30 minutes away.
Yeah, but I think you talked about this history part, and I do think I could see it becoming more popular with time for sure. I think the hurdle, though, is that Americans are very unaccustomed to following closely a league that they is not considered the best league in the world for its sport. And it's hard to see MLS ever being that. So I guess in that context, Alex, do you think soccer could have that unifying civic effect in off World Cup years in this country the way way the Knicks have in New York? Could it ever get there, or is it kind of like trapped in a strata below?
Yeah, I mean, I think, thank you for pandering to me, by the way. I think one of the things, though, is that if you want to watch, you know, if you want to watch an American play at the highest level, right, you can watch Serie A. You could watch Christian Pulisic play at AC Milan. You could watch Weston McKennie play at Juventus, right? There are any number of American fans that are playing in the Premier League right now. I think one of the tricky things for U.S. soccer fandom is just how diffuse it is. I kind of bristle sometimes when we talk about the youth of American soccer fandom, even though that's largely true. But, you know, there are Latino communities, particularly on the West Coast, that have been following, that are very large, that have been following soccer very closely. It just happens to be, you know, usually the Mexican Soccer League or La Liga. And I think, you know, one of the tricky things here, I think, is do we use MLS as the sort of grade stick for how we're progressing? And I think, one, MLS has gotten a lot better. But one of the reasons why I think we finally started actually progressing over the last 20 years or so is that, you know, for the first 15 years of its existence, basically, the MLS was the be all and end all of American soccer. Building that was what mattered. Keeping Americans there was what mattered. And I think what we've seen, you know, more and more are Americans sort of outgrowing that when appropriate and finding their level abroad. And that's made the international team better, but it's made MLS stronger too. You know, MLS now is better than it's been at any point in my life. That's partly thanks to international stars like Leo Messi. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's just trickier here because, you know, baseball is our sport, right? But I think soccer is more popular than it is, you know, generally. It's just that those fans now, you know, if you're a fan of baseball, right, there are 30 teams for you to like.
Right.
If you're a fan of soccer, there are the 20 plus.
And that's what makes it feel different, yeah. Right? And it's just like becoming a civic language often requires there being a single focus for all the fans, right? And so soccer, and I believe it, soccer is as popular, maybe more popular than basketball, than baseball, and let's say not American football, but those two, it's just not all concentrated in the way it becomes concentrated during the World Cup. And that's what sweeps all of us casual folks into it. It's the fact that like everyone's talking about it and we're all watching together. And that's the thing that's hard to get in the off years, Jose. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we can ever really get there. Even if there's many more eyeballs on the sport than there are baseball and basketball and hockey.
I still think of my college roommates who I could not get to go touch a soccer ball, but I could sure as heck get them to pick up a controller and play FIFA with me.
Right? Yeah, right. So the video game, yeah.
Yeah, so get them to play FIFA with me on a video game console and want to learn more, but still stay an arm's length away because they were more interested in what was going on at the time. I was at Chapin's University, but what's going on with the Pittsburgh Pirates or the Washington Nationals, I think, and even the Eagles back home. So it's gonna take time, and as Alex mentioned, is MLS the measuring stick? I'm not sure, but it certainly has been progressing as it has exported more and more players abroad to go and earn their stripes.
Starmid on YouTube says NFL best football in the world, NHL best hockey players in the world playing it, NBA best basketball players in the world playing it, MLB best baseball players in the world playing it, MLS not so much. That's their point. Josh says, I feel like there are too many professional sports in the U.S. where it makes it hard for soccer to gain more traction because we only have so much time. Football, basketball, baseball, hockey, the list goes on. Let's bring in another caller. Ramona from Doylestown is on the line. Ramona, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Yes, our sons play soccer, and we followed soccer for a long time. In the World Cup, I've noticed and I've appreciated some teams that have been, I would say, very gentlemanly, and they play soccer. They don't lie on the ground and ride around with fake injuries. And that's what I've appreciated, those teams that really play soccer. Thank you.
Yeah. And
I wonder what team she's talking about.
I don't know. And by the way, one of our producers had this question. And I got to ask this question because it kind of piggybacks on what that caller was talking about. She said
England was bad. England's a bunch of.
You mentioned England as a bad one.
Okay, oh, I don't know.
This idea that when people, you see the game, if you're a new fan and you're watching it, and then people, you know, they don't even really get tapped, and they roll on around on the ground like there's very, in a very dramatic fashion. You both, you know, nodding your heads a little bit like, you know, this is true. What is that to new fans as you're watching this? And you're like, is he hurt? He's not really hurt. Are they trying to get a foul? Like, what's trying to get a red card? I don't even know. But explain that.
It's gamesmanship. It's figuring out when to slow down the game, when to bring it to a halt.
People trying to catch a breath?
Catch a breath, figure out tactically, do we need to slow down momentum? To Ramona's point, I'm not sure if she has watched the NBA lately, especially the Knicks.
They're very dramatic.
Because they're very good at flopping.
They are very dramatic.
Jalen Brunson.
But you kind of understand that a little bit more, because if you're a new fan, you're like, but you're right. The NBA, I watch a lot of women's basketball, and they're very dramatic, you know, and then they get right back up and keep
playing. It's tactical. It
doesn't bother me, to be perfectly honest.
Though, to be fair, the one player yesterday from Belgium that did go down right before the much dreaded and I think hated hydration break did end up tearing his ACL. So you have injuries that are actually injuries. Yes. For the record, but Alex is probably nodding behind me. It's tactical.
Yeah. Oh, let me read this. Go ahead, Alex. Yeah.
Oh, no, I think it is a leap for people. I just think every sport has these things. Yeah, the other thing I would say too is, it's a contact sport too. I think people are actually they don't appreciate how physical it is in some ways, because it doesn't seem physical because the guys are all my size basically.
I do want to ask this because there are people who want to, you know, what would be your advice? Follow your local team, because I know Avi, he tried to follow his a team. He only made it a week. And this was like after the last World Cup. I mean, how do you sort of attach yourself to a team? Because, I mean, besides buying the cool swag or whatever, like, and you're like, you know what? I really love the World Cup. I want to have this feeling, you know, even when there's not a World Cup in my backyard. How do you sort of like attach yourself to a team and make soccer your sport?
I would say it's frankly finding that community, right? A lot of the great stuff happens between the lines, and winning, of course, speeds this up. But the reality is it's going to the Top Tomatoes of the world and watching a game with people, going to a different place to wake up early in the morning and watch a Premier League game with people that you maybe don't see on a weekly basis, but you see on the weekends at 9 a.m. over a pint of beer and just share stories about what was going on during your week. And even here with the Philadelphia Union, being part of the 18,000 strong that get up there every single weekend to watch this team, albeit bad this year, still get together to want to take it in and use it as their way to socialize.
Yeah, let me sneak in another caller. This is Ross calling from the Schuylkill Expressway. Ross, I hope you're being safe, hands free. Ross, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Comment is, I think we're missing the impact of two other outside factors. The women's national team being absolutely so dominant for so many years, and the popularity of the TV show Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
I think have really kind of brought it full circle where it's becoming very serious here in the States.
Yeah. Great call. Thank you, Ross. You.
Yeah, the women's team, they've done a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't
for other women's sports, too.
Absolutely. Greg says, I want to comment on the World Cup to talk about my point in the opening monologue. Most Americans won't pay attention for another 4 years. That's because local news barely covers the Union, let alone the MLS. That's radio true. Sports shows don't even mention football at all. I was talking about soccer there. The day after the U.S. beat Bosnia, the sports radio shows were all over the Sixers' big trade for a sport in its offseason. Fans can't support a sport in the U.S. alone. We need more coverage. Jose's on the case, by the way.
Try my best.
Let me ask you, as we get ready to wrap up, Alex, this is sort of a contrarian take on the whole Trump thing, but it struck me in the past that this is just a gut feeling that a lot of the American soccer fans leaned a little bit more like urban liberal. Is it possible that the Trump effect here could be to broaden the sort of the demographics of who is interested in soccer, make the more conservative leaning sports fans, more into the sport. Is that a growth area for American soccer potentially?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is, especially, being a fan of professional soccer, it tends to code, educated, professional class kind of person. Yeah. Or, one of the big problems with U.S. development soccer is just that it's so expensive to play for a lot of people. It tends to, the U.S. team is fairly middle class for the most part. I mean, I think one of the issues that we have in general is bringing in just different types of people, right? I mean, I find the endless conversation about if, Allen Iverson played striker, with the U.S. won the World Cup in 2006 to be very frustrating. But I think that, the issue is really that there are a lot of very good wide receivers that are playing at like MAC schools in Division II or something that we should be trying to bring through the pipeline. So whether those people are sort of MAGA coded or they're just in, what we would call like high school football places, right? Those are the kinds of people that you want to bring in. And I would say with the U.S. team, until the, debacle that began on Sunday afternoon, one of the things that I thought was really special about this team is that it was a team for everybody here, right? It wasn't just, it's always been an issue with Team USA, but if you wanted to get into this sport, if you wanted to have somebody to root for here, you could attach yourself to almost anyone on this team, regardless of where you were politically or culturally.
Well, I have to add with this comment from Heidi, who says, I was introduced to Premier League soccer while living in London in the early 80s. I've been a fan since. It saddens me to see the American teams far behind some others in the world, but hope springs eternal, as any Nick fan knows.
good
comment, Heidi. There's always hope. There's Alex Shepard, senior editor of the New Republic, co-creator of Golden Goal, a single issue magazine about the 2026 FIFA World Cup. Alex, thank you for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And Jose Nunez, Philadelphia Union beat reporter, contributor to MLSsoccer.com, covering the World Cup matches here in Philly. Jose, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thank you both.
And by the way, I was admiring all the swag of all, including you, Avi. Everybody was swagged out. I shout out to that. And by the way, I want to shout out our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May, Brian Page, Murray Bessler, and our newest teammate, the one and only Ben Abrams. Ben, welcome to the team. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you tomorrow.